Welcome to an iTech 15 speaker presentation. This file has been brought to you by Christian Education National. Enjoy and connect to www.cen.edu.au for more information.
Welcome to, as you would understand, the Q&A session. This session lives or dies whether, you know, based on whether you want to ask questions of these people or not. I also understand, though, that some of you may well be here because you're just kind of intrigued and you want to know a little bit more about some of our keynote speakers and other speakers. So what I'd like to do first of all is to actually ask them to tell us a little bit about more about themselves, and I'll do that via an interview. I think we might start with Beth. Actually, little funny story that Beth actually didn't realise she was on this panel until about four, maybe three
well
minutes
prepared,
ago.
Well prepared, as you can tell.
She's very graciously still agreed to jump up here. Beth, tell us, where are you from, first of all?
I'm from Manchester in the northwest of England.
That's not
where I live anymore.
Yeah, where are you living now?
I live in Hamilton, which is just outside of Toronto in Canada.
What are you doing there?
I'm working for CARDIS, who are a Christian social policy think tank, and I direct their education research program. Do I need to tell you some more?
And also, tell us a little bit about why we would have asked you to be a part of this panel.
Okay. I'm basically here in Australia to talk about the what-if learning approach, which is a distinctively Christian approach to teaching and learning. I'm doing quite a lot of consultancy work after this in Sydney and in Brisbane. And I spend my time kind of thinking about how research in Christian education can support what teachers do, and also how we can get them to think in much more integrated ways about the relationship between Christian faith and teaching and learning.
Yep.
So I assume that's why you want me on the panel rather than to ask me questions about Hamilton or Manchester.
Yes, indeed. Now, you know David.
I do.
We heard from David this morning. So what's your link with David?
Well, when I was a graduate student doing my doctoral research, I used to go to a conference held by an organisation called the Stapleford Centre. And that was a Christian education conference, and it was really helpful to me thinking through my doctoral work. David didn't work for the Stapleford Centre anymore by that point, but he had done and used to come to some of the conferences. So that's where I first met David, and his support and the support of people like Trevor Cooling and John Short, who were known to some of you as well, was really important for me when I was doing that research. And it's kind of kept me in the field of Christian education and committed to building that field as a research field. So that's okay. How I know David.
Yeah. Great. Thank you, Beth, and welcome to our panel. Jefferson. Do people call you Jefferson?
Either or, yeah. It's probably 50-50.
Thank you.
Jefferson.
Thank you.
Usually if my mom's mad at me type of thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. I get
people know that. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you again for this morning. Tell us, people are a little intrigued. Mm-hmm. We heard a little snippet this morning, kind of a family context of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
One of your YouTube videos, you talk about your mum being a single mum. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about you in terms of your upbringing.
Yeah, so I was raised in a broken home, single mom. My dad was around, but wasn't really like any sense of, like, I've never asked him for a piece of advice or anything like that. But definitely had a relationship with my dad growing up from the very beginning. So it was that type of dynamic and relationship. But definitely was just mainly me and my mom. And I don't know if she did it just because she wanted. We kind of were, raised in poverty, government housing, bad neighborhoods, all that stuff. And so I don't know if it was just because she wanted to make sure that I had a successful path in front of me or not, but I got brought to church kind of seasonally. Like, it wasn't like we were there all the time, and I wouldn't even call ourselves kind of cultural Christians is what we call them in the States. Or like a church kid, I mean, because I wasn't there enough, but we did go enough to know the culture of Christianity is what I mean. And so to know the games and the songs and kind of what Jesus did and the flannel board, I don't know if you guys had that too. It's like the best, right? And the goldfish crackers, all that stuff from Sunday school. And so I remember that stuff, and that was kind of my knowledge of Jesus, you know, the cross, the resurrection, and all that. But it never really just, it never became real to me. Like it didn't to most in my generation growing up in the States, which is why I think the percentage of 70 to 80% by the time they get to college leave. I would actually argue that's similar to my talk this morning, where it was never the truth with flesh. It was just these facts, and that will never be enough to kind of give that fulfillment to someone.
It wasn't intimate.
Yeah, exactly. And I never had that intimate experience with the Lord. So by high school, college, I just kind of said whatever and just kind of went and did my own thing. And then it was freshman year of college when God just kind of really radically got a hold of me. Things started to not, like, God can get your attention in a lot of different ways. The way he got my attention, because I was very hard-headed and persistent, was like everything had to go bad. You know, and I mean like everything, like in 2 weeks. 2 weeks, I think it was like my first serious girlfriend broke up with me, who I thought I was going to marry. I got kicked off the baseball team, even though I was the only reason I went to university at that school. And then I got put on academic probation, which if you do that twice, you get kicked out and you waste like $40,000 of tuition money. So yeah, that is basically, like, that happened in a week. So not the best week. And for me, that was actually what was needed, though, because of my whole, like, it was kind of like what I talked about this morning, where, you know, me on the throne of my own life, like, until I saw that it didn't work, I would have kept going that route. So it was about 1920 when I finally turned to the scriptures in humility, realizing, man, I need something, I need help. Me, you know, being that ultimate authority doesn't end well. And yeah, that's when I would have said I started following Jesus freshman, sophomore year.
And you said that's age 19 or 20, not in 1920.
No, I'm not that old. No. That's like back to the Great Depression. No. Which probably means nothing, because that's U.S. history. But So when I was 19 or 20, and that was actually a journey for me too, which I always like to make a point of that, where I think, and again, I don't know the culture here, but in the States, it's very much like there's almost like an idolizing of that moment experience of coming to Jesus. And for me, I didn't have that. So then I started to really question myself a lot. And that led to a lot of ache and depression and kind of confusion. Because for me, it was like 3 to 4 months where I was really searching the scriptures, praying, thinking, wanting more of Jesus, saying no to sin. And then 4 months in, I like looked backwards and kind of looked at my life. And I was like, oh, I guess I'm a Christian now. You know, like I wasn't really taking mental note. You know, I just kind of was like, well, my heart's changed. I don't like the things I used to like. I like the things I don't used to like, right? And so I was like, well, it seems like a new heart, you know? Mm. And then I just kept moving forward. So for me, that was that. I'm 26, so that was about 6 or 7 years ago. And ever since, yeah, I've just been trying to learn what it means to be a faithful follower of Jesus. Yeah. And the spoken word and all that stuff came about 3 years ago, where I just wanted to engage the college I was going to, a non-Christian place, and start writing poetry. And then that's kind of put one on YouTube, and then boom, it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, yeah, an accidental.
Yeah, I'd like to ask more about that. I won't indulge myself and take time from these people's questions. Just before we get to Ken, how this is going to work, there is a roving mic and there's a volunteer with that mic, I hope. Yes, excellent. So if you could indicate prior to the next question, if you have a question, indicate to those guys, if you keep an eye out for people, and we'll get the mic to you. So if anyone's got a question, now, indicate now, these guys will bring the mics around. Ken, who are you? Most of us know, but just in case there's someone who doesn't.
I started my working life as a primary teacher in government schools, and I thought that was a good thing to do. It was a good context, I thought, to have a pretty active church ministry, and also to try and have a kind of evangelistic ministry in the government schools on the side. And that was great for about 15 years. And then I went through a period of being unsettled. I think that was God unsettling me. And I really got challenged about education rather than just seeing the schooling context as a opportunity for evangelism, whether God, in fact, was interested in the whole business of education. And so I began a journey and started teaching in a Christian school. I had been very resistant to Christian schooling up until that point. But I did a sort of 180 and started learning about Christian education and became quite enthusiastic, and found myself a principal of a small Christian school and knowing very little about leading a school and even less about leading it in a way that was faithful to the gospel. And at that time, the National Institute began, and I started to study in a master's degree, mainly because I just wanted to find out how to do this thing. And I got very excited about the whole business of philosophy of Christian education. And when I finished being principal of that place, as well as doing some other things, I began to be a lecturer with the National Institute and have been there ever since, and done some leadership with CEN as well, which I'm relinquishing shortly, but continuing with the Institute. So that's me.
All right, thank you, Ken. Do we have a question? Hand up if you have a question. Excellent, if microphones can start heading there. Now, David, we heard a lot about your story this morning. Great window into who you are and how you came to be thinking the way you do now. Can you tell us a little bit about some everyday things? Tell us about your family. What's kind of ordinary work day look like for you as well? Both those things.
Family. My wife works at the same college that I do. We're both from the UK, but work at a college in Michigan. And she oversees all the sexuality programming at our college, so nice and low stress and non-controversial. And we have three kids. My oldest is finished college a couple of years ago. He's married, living in Grand Rapids, works in refugee resettlement. My middle daughter is in Mississippi studying ballet. Just totally logical for a British emigre girl. And my youngest just finished high school and is starting at Calvin College in the fall.
Yep.
So, typical work day. I would say one of my biggest life struggles is that there aren't many typical days, actually, so it's very hard to get rhythms and routines. So there's a fair amount of travel. When I'm in town, I will get up. I may have emailed with people on most continents by mid-morning. I teach classes to undergrads and graduates at Calvin College. I'm an administrator. I'm running a program. We have a couple of big research projects going, so we're doing a lot of data entry this summer from two big research projects. Spotter writing.
I think that sets the scene for us. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. We have a question. Great. Thank you.
Hi. Particularly wanted to address it to David. Really enjoyed your presentation this morning. But just in terms of when you're talking about using your curriculum to sort of create Christian community and sort of a Christian ethos within your class, as a first-year teacher myself, and part of a school where there's a number of classes across each grade level and so on, you kind of get handed a curriculum in a sense. Can you just give me some advice kind of working in that sort of framework where you're not designing the curriculum for yourself but working within it, I guess, how you go about doing what you're talking about?
Yeah. I think the first thing that's worth saying is I don't believe there's such a thing as a teaching context that comes without constraints, right? Wherever you work, there are going to be things that are already in place. There are going to be things that you're answerable to. There are going to be agendas that other people have got. What I often tell my own education students is I think it's psychologically dangerous to look at those things as constraints. I think it's more helpful to look at them as design parameters. So I say if you think about, I mean, I'm not an engineer, so this analogy may be fuzzy around the edges, but I imagine that if an engineer is going to design a bridge, right, they might have an ideal bridge in their mind, but what they're actually going to have to do is go look at what kind of rock is on both sides of the river and what it will take, and they're going to have to look at how much traffic's going to go across this particular bridge in this location, and they're going to have to look at whether the town that the bridge is in is a tourist spot and whether it has to be beautiful, and they're going to have to look at the budget that the state gave them and the timeline they've got to get it completed on and the availability of skilled labour. And within all of those parameters, they've got to try to build a good bridge, right? So I actually think the task of being a Christian teacher is to figure out what your parameters are and then treat them as design parameters and try to figure out how to be faithful within those parameters. So if I've got a curriculum that somebody else created, I've got to start looking at my options. First, is it bad enough that I need to campaign to change it? Because that's one option, right? If it's not bad enough that that's necessary, then how do I work with it? What's good in it? What can I adapt? And also, you know, curriculum, we'd have to have a longer conversation about what we mean by curriculum, because my curriculum is not just the textbook or the content that's been assigned, but what practices are you building around that content? What do you ask the students to do with it? That's as much curriculum as, and that's pretty rarely prescribed, right? You might have been given a textbook or you might have been given a series of topics to cover, but start asking yourself, what are all the different ways that one could engage that topic or that skill or that piece of information? Just because I've been given the textbook doesn't mean that I have to teach it the way the textbook tells me I have to teach it. So, I mean, without knowing your curriculum, I don't know how to get sort of concrete on this, but to me, in every teaching situation, most of the examples I used, I was teaching in a situation where I was actually in state schools in the UK under the British National Curriculum, which was had a lot of pretty tight requirements. But it became pretty clear to me that there was never only one way to meet those requirements. There were always other possibilities as to how I could ask students to engage with the things that they were being asked to learn. Does that help?
It does, thank you.
Another question, while the mic moves to there. Anybody? Oh yeah, here we go, down over here. Thank you. Can I just ask, David, just to follow on from that question. We've talked about the constraints of the curriculum, design parameters. What about, I mean, you said today that your practice will tell a story. Your practice shapes us. Yet, when we work in a school, we are working in an institution that has a very prescribed sort of shape to it already that we've inherited, you know, Industrial Revolution and so on. Would you say the same answer in terms of how do we then shape some of those inherent things in the very design of schooling
right.
that are telling a story?
Well, yeah, again, I mean, to me, there are some unhelpful narratives that you can get into here. I mean, one is, well, schools are just the way they are, you can't change it. Well, that's just a council of despair. I might as well just quit and go find something more useful to do. Mm-hmm. It's also not terribly helpful to work with this kind of vision where I can't actually make any headway until I can tear the whole thing down and go build the monastery in the desert or something. Again, to, you know, look at the existing set of practices and say which ones most urgently need to change and what are the pathways to starting to change them. And I just tend to be very pragmatic about this and think, well, the first thing that I have agency over is actually my own practices in my own classroom. I can start there, yep. right? I can start to change things. And if I can find ways of changing things that look fruitful, that actually create student learning, create student engagement, that actually turn out to be interesting and not just religious weird, then I might actually be able to persuade colleagues that they're a good idea too. Yep. And if enough of us start doing it that way, then we start to have a case to go to the administration and say that some of the structures need to change to allow these new practices to flourish. And I think that's one vector on which you can work towards institutional change.
Okay.
I mean, you can also campaign in other ways for institutional change, but my own instinct has been to say, God's not going to give me a pass until other people fix the institution. I've got the responsibility of the teaching and learning that I'm responsible for in my classroom, and I've got to figure out how to do that faithfully. If I wait for society and schooling to be perfectly structured before I try to be faithful, then I'm going to retire and it won't have arrived.
Thanks, Ben.
I just wondered if I could come in because I think there are also some stories in the research that are helping with this broader conversation about the nature of institutions in education. If you look at some of the bigger kind of global trends, there's an increasing discontent with this idea that, you know, one size in education should fit all. There are lots of kind of big names critiquing the ways in which we've structured our institutions and asking whether, even if you did think education was just about getting a job, whether actually the ways in which we're doing school are equipping people to be employable. So there are some stories there that kind of reinforce when you ask those questions in your staff meetings or when you're thinking about what you might want to do differently. And I think it's really important to plug into some of those and perhaps think about the little shifts in practice that you can achieve as almost like research projects, many research projects. Think about that, because engaging in research and critically evaluating your own practice, I found for me that was an oasis. It actually helped me to feel that I had some agency in the process and I wasn't just having to do everything that kind of came down from on high. I had my little areas in which I could subverse and think differently and find other people who thought like me, and things can grow from that. So, yeah.
That's helpful. Thanks, Beth. Question over here.
Hi. First of all, I just wanted to thank you because I found a lot of the talks really quite inspirational in terms of just opening up and unpacking a lot of things. But I often find there's a real disconnect at conferences when you have these inspirational ideas and then you go back to your school, and especially I find in an independent school, there's this subculture that doesn't want to be a part of the bigger culture. And you try to kind of prepare these young minds for what they'll experience outside of school. And, you know, you get to we've got a kinder to grade 12 school, and a lot of the kids leave at the end of grade 10 and they go to the public schools and they are just complete culture shock. And I had that experience coming from my Christian education to a public system as well. It's really nervous talking in front of all these people. I just guess I wanted some insights into that, how you... I have this aim, and then it's really difficult to kind of burst this kind of escapist view from many of the stakeholders of the school, where we are encouraged to protect kids rather than prepare them.
Directed to anyone in particular, or can I call on Ken?
No, yeah, call on Ken. Ken's probably the best person to start.
Yeah, look, I think that is a real issue. In some research that I did, and it involved Year 10 students, that was a big issue that kept recurring, that they felt that they were overprotected. In fact, there was one particular student stands in my mind where they said that they felt unable to talk to their teachers about real issues that were happening to them in their life in the Christian school. And I asked them, why was that? And they said they wouldn't cope. And I found that a tragic response, that that we've got this kind of sanitised environment where there's a sense in which we can't cope with the messiness of life and the real issues that are concerning kids. And I think that I agree with you, that's one of the big challenges of not just protecting kids, because that is a motivation for a lot of people, but moving from protection to preparation for real engagement, where the kids can be confident to engage with the secular world, if you like, without being overcome by it, but also lovingly and with hospitality going into it. I think it's one of the biggest challenges we have as Christian schools, rather than being sort of insular. I'd be interested in what my other panel members say about that. I've just agreed with you.
Yeah. Thanks, Beth.
I'm a graduate of a Christian school myself. My parents were part of a group that founded a small independent Christian school in the UK, which I guess was influenced by some of the models that you have here in Australia. And so it's interesting because I went through that until I was the age of 16, and then I went to into the state system. Personally, I had a ball, had a whale of a time, but I know that I've got some of my other classmates really struggled. And trying to kind of understand some of that explains, you know, the path I've taken in my own career. I was a teacher before I moved into research. And I think I would say two things in response to your question. The first is we've got to get better at not just asking questions, but not seeing asking questions as threatening in Christian schools. There has to be an open and a safe place for students to ask their questions, for dialogue to be engaged in. Now, that actually, I guess that goes to how we train teachers and how we equip teachers to answer those questions. I was really fortunate. I had a home environment, a church environment, and school environment where you could pretty much ask anything. I think that might be quite rare, and that's a shame. And lots of my friends ended up, because those questions had not been tabled, with their faith kind of not really being strengthened, not really being built on, and because it was never tested, they hadn't built resilience. And so some of them are not currently within the church, and, you know, and were thrown by that transition experience. I think the second point, though, is also recognizing that God loves the universe. God is in the world, and that he's doing so much more out there than sometimes we give him credit for in the Christian school space, that there are good things happening, that common grace is there, that he can encounter people outside of the four walls that we build in our schools. And acknowledging that is something that's really important in the what-if learning approach that I've been involved in building, and not, you know, just kind of giving God credit for that and being open about that in terms of how we build, how we think about community and the world out there and the way that we relate to it. We are part of God's creation, and he is there and he's doing things, and it's our call to join him in what he's already doing.
Thank you. Question down here. Thanks. Maybe if we could try and indicate in advance to the ushers so we don't need to wait for the microphones. There we go.
Jeff, I'm interested. You mentioned some in your generation who are walking away from faith, and because maybe they've only had truth and not intimacy. Are you seeing any success at some of those people coming back, and what are some insights that you can give that maybe would be helpful in reaching out to some of those who have rejected their faith?
Wow, that's a tough one. I think it has to be real. And in the, I think I'm seeing a lot of people, at least in the States, which, you know, you are, or at least were, what, 30 years ago you said? But, what I'm seeing there is that there's a lot of people with similar stories of mine where leave for a season, and then they get to a point where they either almost kind of solidify that, or they kind of understand that it maybe is not the best. And so... But the interesting thing that's happening in the States, I would say, is that I think that, yeah, there's a lot of cultural shift going on. There's a lot of, the way I've heard it said is that the church is no longer the moral majority, but the prophetic minority in America now. And I think that's a real beautiful thing. I mean, you might not think it is, but I do. I think we get a little sloppy when we're the moral majority. I think we get a little just bad, right? Just does not turn into what we were supposed to be. And so... I think that shift is happening. We're in the middle of that shift, and I see that kind of then being a regaining of really beautiful truths, a real call to intimacy with the Lord, a real relationship, not about the rules and the regulations, and just kind of fitting things in its context. I don't know if that's exactly what you're asking, but that is kind of what I'm seeing. And then one thing, too, that I really try hard in my YouTube videos and try hard in anything I do, whether it's a podcast with my wife or whatever, is, like, God is not boring. And I just get really upset when, like we Christians are like the big buzzkill community. Are you with me? Like he's not boring. We are the place of the feast and the celebration, so why don't we look like that? And so I try to ask, like, how do we do that? How do we show what true joy is? You know, not just the parties that leave you sick the next day. That's not what I'm talking about, right? That's the world's version. But how do we actually call people into a real deep joy, and how do we display that? I think when you display that, it kind of has a life of its own. I don't know if you guys have seen... Walter Mitty, or A Secret, like whatever that movie's called, the full title. There's a line in there where he says, what's he say? He says, yeah, I think he basically gets to a point where he basically says that beautiful things don't have to ask for attention, meaning they don't have to stand over there and say, hey, look at me, look at me, look at me. Beautiful things just are, right? They compel and they woo on their own. So I think when we can get back to that, of show what it looks like to be, I've seen really powerful transformations in people's lives, including my own, when I see, like, the new kingdom humanity, the new humanity that God creates, right, in Ephesians 2, like, at work, rather than just, hey, come to Jesus because he died for your sins. When I actually see this is what it looks like, and then I get invited to that table, that really is what transforms my life. One quick example I'll give you is, again, I don't totally know the culture here, but in the States, I for 3 or 4 years, I would meet with, like, a mentor of mine over at Starbucks, you know, for a week, and we'd go through, like, a Bible study or something. And that was great. I'm not saying it's bad, but I did that for, like, years and years, and it was semi-transformational, right? But then another mentor of mine, he kind of splits time between Jerusalem and the States. He invited me and Alyssa over to live with his family in Jerusalem for a couple weeks. And those 2 weeks were the most transformational weeks of my life, because I was actually living with him, and I saw how he loved his wife, how he loved his kids, how he disciplined his kids, how he taught them, how they went through, they homeschooled, but how he educated, how they did meals together, how they prayed, how they worshiped. And in that immersive context, I was a lot more transformed. And so I think that's just a small example of, I think we have to really get back to that, of inviting people into our lives. And the hard part is we don't do that because it's messier, right? Like, get out of my home, this is my private space, just meet me at church on Sunday, right? But that's not, I don't think, the Jesus way. I think the Jesus way is really inviting people to the table in your life. And for me, it's been really transformational. But that's what I've hopefully been seeing, and I hopefully am excited about that, that we keep getting back to that.
Thank you for the question. Do we have the mic for someone else? Yep, here we go.
Yeah, Jeff, I think you
sort of... me again.
Yes, you again. You alluded to some of this in what you were just saying, but this morning in your presentation, and forgive me if this isn't a perfect quote, but you said something about that you infuse truth with life when you do it as a part of life. And I'm just curious to know, as Christians and as the church, how we play that out in our communities.
Yeah, and I would love to hear other people's answer on this one, because you're asking the young guy this question, which is, you don't want to hear my answer. I need to live a lot longer before I can give a better answer. What I would say, at least in the very few brief years of being married, you know, having a daughter and kind of really trying to engage this context in that question, there's a lot of different answers to that, but this one might sound really weird or kind of anticlimactic, but eat together more. I know it sounds really weird, but I just have literally seen, like, I mean, I used table as a metaphor this morning, but I actually literally mean it right now. Like, I mean, literally eat together. I know that sounds weird, but if you look in church revivals, if you look at certain communities that are strong, if you look at the New Testament church, a huge part of the ethic of that is meals together. And there's something about that, right? There's a reason that Jesus put the Last Supper at the table, in a meal, stuff of that nature. And so I just think something happens when you use the three or four, how many times you eat a day, natural rhythm of life to sit down and be equalized. I know it's a weird way to put it, but when you're sitting down, you're all equal. No one's taller, right? No one's shorter. You're all looking at each other face to face. You're not staring at the back of people's heads, which is, that's exactly what church is, right? You're actually doing life together, and you're not only recognizing the provision that's needed from God, right, by eating, but also that's where, I don't know about you, but that's where, like, stories are told. That's where you learn about someone. Like, the most I know about my closest friends has happened over usually food, right? Like, it's just the life we live, right? That's why, I'm sure English people know it, right? That just the tea, and if something's going to happen, pull out the tea, right? Like, and I've been there.
Essential ingredient.
Yeah, exactly. And I've experienced it where there's something about a lot of cultures, if you go back through, that there's an element of that where we know, without even recognizing it, that that's, I think, a huge element of doing life together. I could flesh that out a ton more, but that's just one, I would say.
If you're ever in the States, then you know of somewhere you can go for dinner.
That's right.
Another question, or because we do have one down here yet.
Oh, I wanted to hear their answers on that one, no?
We'll move on for the moment if we've got time to come back.
Okay.
That's a great answer, Jeff.
I think it was Jefferson yesterday was saying that in the all the different stories, that life is about who has the best story wins, is that sort of feeling that you get. And so in education, we're training people to have the best story in the end, whether it's about the most money, the most successful career. David, this morning you spoke about trying to get rid of ego, essentially, in learning by saying that the story isn't all about them, and you had all those I sentences. Other than just changing the focus of those sentences, what else can we do to get rid of ego in learning so that it's not just about my story that I'm making?
Need an hour for that. I would start with things like, I mean, for me, it started with actually looking at what sentences am I having my students practice. Do I have them practice only speaking about themselves, or do I have them practice listening to other people? So one of my students actually came up in one of my education courses, came up with a nice activity where students had to engage in discussion around a topic, and then they were given a matrix to fill out, where they had to put in the names of the other people in their group, and they had to answer questions about what the other people's views were on the topic that they'd just been discussing, to test whether you'd actually really been listening to the other people in your group, or whether you'd just been mentally rehearsing what you wanted to say next in the conversation. I would do things like, you know, in my language classes, I have one of my units that actually culminates in requiring my students to go out and interview an elderly person for an hour and listen to their story and come back and use that as a basis for storytelling in the classroom and practicing past tense narrative and so on. So sometimes it's literally connecting with other people. I teach another unit where I have my students write short stories, and I connect them with middle school children in Switzerland, and each of my students gets assigned a Swiss child to write a story for, and they then send the story over there. The Swiss school uses it for literacy work, and they get feedback from eight-year-old Swiss kids on how good their story was. So again, that's just trying to broaden the bubble from, instead of, you know, I'm just writing this to impress the teacher and get a grade. No, I'm actually trying to write this to do something good for another person. I know of a school in Indiana that actually their eighth grade Spanish curriculum, they structured the whole year around having the students identify local nonprofits that worked with the Hispanic community and choose one of those nonprofits. And then the class actually spent the year helping that nonprofit develop more online materials in Spanish, develop brochures, etc. And they built all the language work around that as a year-long project. So the whole point of learning Spanish was to serve the local community. So, I mean, you know, we could go on spinning examples, right? I mean, it's a question of saying, what kind of learning activity is going to force my students to reach outside themselves, to engage with someone else, to take someone else seriously, to listen to their story? And then there's always this dual move, right, of trying to change the practices, but also telling the story that makes sense of the practices and doing the practices that make sense of the story, right? Either one of those on its own, I think, is not enough. And just as a quick example of what can happen when that starts to shift, a few years back I was sitting in my office and I had a phone call, and it was one of my students from several years earlier who was now in Germany and was phoning me from Germany, and he was so excited he could barely get his words out. And I sort of calmed him down, and he said, I've got to tell you what happened this morning. He said, I got on a bus in Germany, and the next stop, the bus stopped, and this other guy got on, this young guy, and he came and he sat down next to me, and he just looked so depressed. And I know I learned in class that you don't talk to strangers as much in Germany as you do in America, but I figured I could get away with it because I was American. And so so I just asked him how he was doing, and it turned out he said that he'd just come from his workplace, and he'd just lost his job, just been fired. And he was on his way home, and he didn't know how he was going to tell his wife that he didn't have a job anymore. And he said, and then I remembered what you said in class, and I thought, oh my goodness, what did I say in class, and what damage have I just done in Germany? And what he referred me back to was where I'd been talking in class about how we learn a foreign language so that we can hear other people, not just so that we can bless more of the world with our opinion. And I'd done a little devotion around that, and it'd also been a focus on some of our practices. And he said, I remembered what you told us in class about how we're learning German so we can listen to other people. So I just sat and listened to him for 20 minutes and let him tell his story. And at the end, I told him that I would pray for him. And he was just so thankful that he'd had somebody to get it off his chest to before he had to talk to his wife and sort of run through it one time. And he got off the bus, and I was so excited I had to come and tell you. And I thought, if I've got a 24-year-old affluent young American man, right, and what happened out of his language education, it has gone to Germany, and the thing that he's so excited about that he has to call his professor in America right away to tell him is not that he visited the Reichstag or that he did the beer fest or whatever, but that he got to listen to an unemployed person for 20 minutes on a bus, then to me something remarkable just happened, right? That there's some kind of shift has taken place there. So it says, again, it's about trying to build this cumulative web of activities that are both giving students a way of understanding the story that pushes them beyond themselves, but also then practices that back it up in terms of making them pay attention to other people within the learning.
Thanks, Jay. Another question? Over here.
This is a question for anybody. This conference, we've sort of floated around the concept, or we've talked about same-sex marriage a little bit, and I'm wondering whether it's possible for Christians to have a space in the political arena in any country to be outwardly talking about this topic without appearing as being judgmental and maybe putting Christian values and our worldview and enforcing that on people who have a different worldview.
Chris, you did say flirted around the topic, didn't you? Yeah.
Yes, I did.
Who would like to jump in here?
Thanks, I will, Beth. Although I'm, I think we have, in all our interactions in the public space, to speak winsomely and not to assume that people use the same language, the same words that we do to mean the same things. I think we have to understand how we come across. Your phrase about the moral majority was interesting because we have, I think we have to acknowledge that we often speak as Christians from a position of power because of the way that our nation's history, the way that we've in some ways taken advantage of that. And Jesus never spoke the gospel from a position of power, and he befriended. And I sometimes wonder where I would expect to see the Lord Jesus in the contemporary age. I think I might find him on the Pride March. And that means that I have to think very carefully about how I engage with this issue winsomely, because I want to start from a different place when I talk about the issue of sexual identity and relationships. And it's very difficult to get people to move back several steps to where we want to start, which is that question of who we are and how we're created and how we're made. I struggle with an attitude that treats anybody as other, because we are all other in relation to God. And I think we've got to do some careful working out in our schools about how we remain faithful to what we believe the Bible teaches about sexuality, but how we put that into the bigger context of our own identity. And I'm struggling here because I'm thinking about what, you know, how I answer the question in my role, which I get sometimes, which is, a gay couple want to send their child to our Christian school. What do we do about that? And I want to say, great. If they understand what you're teaching, then this is a community where we host a conversation about what it means to be a person, and that has to be shared with that couple, and they need to know what's going to be taught in terms of biblically faithful perspectives on marriage. I'm also sitting here thinking that I know and respect Christians who have a different view on some of those things than I do. And it's how do we change the frame of the debate so we're not pushed into militant and defensive positions, essentially by the media, which is what consistently happens. I don't know if I'm answering your question helpfully. I think what I'm saying is that what you're articulating, I believe it is possible. Yeah.
And can I just add on this? I think... partly because of my wife's work, I've learned more about this in the last few years than I ever intended to. And I don't pretend to understand the whole thing yet, but I do think that it's going to be difficult for us to speak well about this until we can become willing to speak about it in more complex ways. So if you just look in our area, I was watching a documentary the other night. There are literally hundreds of thousands of homeless youth in Chicago. And a massively disproportionate percentage of them are LGBT youth. A number of them thrown out of their homes by evangelical families. And they often don't have secure places to go. They're at very high risk from various kinds of violence on the street, and from drug culture and from prostitution. The suicide rates for gay and transsexual youth are significantly higher than for heterosexual youth. Bullying is rampant, and with sexual minority students on Christian campuses, they can particularly suffer from bullying. Can we actually demonstrate that we're concerned about some of those things, as well as being concerned about political decisions being taken about marriage, which in a sense sort of feels to me like, I mean, it's only one part of a larger network of brokenness around our sexuality. And when we sound like the one thing that Christians want to do is take a political position on one particular piece of this, but we never sound like we care about all the suffering that is going along with it in other contexts, that's when I don't think we come off very well.
Thanks, David. Ken.
Can I just add to that? I agree with what Beth and David have said, that it's a tremendously complex question, and I agree heartily that I was talking to someone at lunchtime and saying that in one sense a Christian school should be the safest place for a person who has a homosexual orientation to be real and to feel safe in exploring what's happening to them. The problem is And I agree we have to work much harder at showing that compassion and understanding the complexity. The problem is that there is a
I believe, a concerted and highly orchestrated media and cultural campaign to redefine things. And the language is such. And they've been very clever in talking about marriage equality. I think the issue is a marriage redefinition. Now, I think we can use that sort of language without coming across as judgmental and picking one particular sin. And we know that heterosexual sin is just as heinous to God as homosexual sin. The problem is there is not a concerted campaign from heterosexual sinners to say, do not tell me I am wrong. That is the problem. And we are forced into a position of if we say we think that homosexual practice is not what the Bible is teaching or against what the Bible is teaching, we are automatically cast as homophobic. So I think that's the other side of the coin. It's a tremendously difficult issue, and I think we've got to approach it both with compassion and with courage of our convictions from what the Bible says.
Thanks, Ken. It was interesting that John Stonestreet yesterday said that he's kind of, in some respects, over-talking about this. But I think as Christian schools, we can't be, at the moment, over-talking about this. This is going to become a significant issue for us to navigate through in the next little bit. Another question? Yep, down the front here. Down here. Thank you.
I'm just really interested in, anyone can answer and stuff, but maybe Jeff to start with is, who do you read? Like, what do you like reading? A bit of your stuff sounded a bit like Eugene Peterson this morning, some of that table stuff. And, I'm just interested in what you guys read, obviously, you know, not necessarily for pleasure, but for your work. Apart from the Bible.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're going to be a good Christian, I got to say that first, right? I go in seasons, I would say, just rolling off the top of my head. Theologians that have really impacted me, if you could tell from the workshop probably yesterday, N.T. Wright, Richard Hayes, Walter Brueggemann is a huge one. I really enjoy Eugene Peterson's work on pastoral and shepherding and relational intimacy and stuff of that nature. Outside of theologians, I really love Ann Voskamp. I really enjoy some nonfiction female writers that I think sometimes get to that, not just being up here, but about all of life. Ann Voskamp, Jen Hatmaker, Shauna Nyquist. Some old ones that I was a huge fan of that really led me to the Lord would be A.W. Tozer and Watchman Nee, which are very random, I think, especially Watchmen. But I would say those are ones that just come on top of my head.
Ken?
What I read?
Yeah.
Oh, and The Hunger Games.
Look, normally I can rattle them off, but can we go somewhere else?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Beth.
I'm reading a book by Matthew Crawford at the moment called The World Outside of Your Head. Now, he's not writing as a Christian author, but he's exploring some of these issues about how distracted and fragmented and partial our lives in the modern world have become. And his question is about bringing attentiveness back into practice and feeling whole again as people. And it was reviewed in Cardus's recent magazine comment by a colleague of mine, Brian Dykmer, who Brian's forever popping into my office and saying, have you read this? Have you read this? And so most of what I read comes via Brian. And I really would recommend it to you as another way of thinking about the fact that people are desperate for this greater vision of what it means to be a person. They are lonely and they need community and they need to do life together. And it's really interesting, James Smith talks about cracks in the secular, that increasingly in the literature by people like David Brooks, Matthew Crawford, that theme is coming through, and that's a real opportunity for us to speak into. I guess with my professional hat on, I'm reading people write about that from a theological position, so like James Hunter, Tom Wright as well. But yeah, read The World Outside Your Head by Matthew Crawford.
Maybe a book that you...
A book. The book I'm reading right now is a bit atypical, actually. I'm quite enjoying a book called Book Was There, It's looking at what the physical practice of learning about the world through books has meant for us, that we're sort of possibly coming to the end of 1,000 years of the book being our dominant technology for engaging the world. And what has it meant for the way that we imagine the world, that we think of it as something, we think of truth as something we can hold in our hands, as something we can close, as something we can put a clasp around. Why do we have handbooks and manuals and this whole notion of sort of connecting knowledge to your hands, and having boundaries and pages? Just talking about the physicality of books and how that's changing with digital media, where just the whole physicality of the reading experience is different, and how's that going to shape us in different ways. And it's quite a nice balanced account. It's not sort of for or against either of the changes particularly, but just trying to describe what's happening.
Thanks, David.
Just the two books I'll take David's leaf. Reading a book, a novel called The Rosie Project. A lot of you may have read that. My wife said I should read it because it's a good description of me, the main character. I'm not too excited about that. But actually, it's a great book that talks about relationships and humanity. It doesn't come from a Christian perspective at all, but these people who are human beings made in God's image can't help rubbing up against what it means to have relationships and what it means to be a human being. On a more serious note, what I'm reading at the moment, rereading, is the book edited by Kevin Van Hooser called Everyday Theology. And I've revisited that book mainly in preparation for this conference. But I think particularly Van Hooser's first chapter is a brilliant help in reading culture and reading the world.
Yep. Thanks, Steph.
My question was sparked by David's answer to the question about the guy on the bus. I would think that as well as your student's excitement at the way he'd put his learning into practice was also a knowledge that you would care that he had learnt it from you, that you shared something. And I guess I wanted to ask anyone as well to comment on the role of the Christian educator as, I guess, a role model relationship. You know, Paul talks about people who follow him. It's a big responsibility where we feel we can let our students down, but a privilege, yeah.
Thanks, Ross. I think that was that directed at David?
Yeah. But, yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, it's interesting the way you put that, because I do think that it's not always helpful to think of modelling as I have to be this perfectly virtuous person that students can then copy, because I'm not. There are days when I don't like my students very much. But I do think that one of the things you model inevitably as a teacher is what you really care about. And again, you do that through your practices and through your enthusiasms and so on. And it is something I sort of think about. You know, I've seen instances where students have been coming back 10 or 20 years later to visit language teachers I've known, and what the students are still proudly showing their language teacher is that they can repeat some arcane German sentence that demonstrates the past perfect tense. And I don't know, there's something touching about that, but it's kind of, I'm not sure that what I most want my students to come back to me and sort of care, you know that I cared about is their ability to repeat this arcane grammatical construction. So it is something I ask myself, is how through my teaching does it become apparent that I care most about the things that ought to be cared most about, and that there are other things that are important too, but they're not quite as life and death. and that I'm not sort of communicating that the life and death thing is getting the ending in the right place and that the rest of life is kind of in the background.
Can I exercise a word of caution as well with the role modeling thing? Only because I think there's a temptation for us sometimes to think that what it means to be a distinctively Christian educator is to be the Christian Mary Poppins. That was something that I struggled with in my early teaching life. So I went to work in a boarding school because I had this amazing idea that if I lived with the students all of the time, I would be Jesus to them, you know, like 100% of the time, and they would see. And I failed at that, and I got considerably burned out. and I think we're often not critical enough or inadequately critical of some of the mentoring models that we've got in the education world, which sort of rely on that, you know, kind of hero dimension or perfect dimension. Just, I guess, David, you said this, but just bringing this out. Actually, it's really important for people to see, you know, some aspects of my frailty and how I wrestle with things, and the fact that I know what actually stood out a lot in my early teaching career was that I apologized to students when I got things wrong. And I did that because my teachers had done that for me, but it was unusual in the context that I was working in. And I think we also have to be aware of how tired teachers get and that the propensity for burnout is real. So you can't take the strain for that kind of as one person on your own. That's why pastoral teams and thinking through the structures of how you build communities of practice are really, really important.
Thanks, Beth. I think we have time for one more question, and I've promised just down here. Yeah, thank you. Yep, there she is. Sorry, Chris.
We've talked a bit about crises and things like these big issues, same-sex marriage, and yesterday someone mentioned terrorism. Some of our kids, you know, get a bit down about all this sort of stuff. It's a, you know, we're facing a lot of, yeah, pretty big subjects. Just I want to open it to anyone. What's your thoughts, briefly, on giving, you know, kids hope in this world that they're living in? The other thing is that we're also very aware of students with increasing mental illness and issues with resilience.
Jeff, you want to jump in?
This is going to be a little backdoor of an answer, but this is actually coming from a book I just read called From Tablet to Table, not to beat a dead horse again about the table, by Leonard Sweet, one of my favorite authors. Also, I didn't mention him. And he talks about a lot of the reason why there's a lack of hope in the next generation is because of not only all the brokenness, but the lack of identity formation from Christian people over them, meaning it's more about giving the facts rather than letting them forming an identity around a bigger story. And he uses two case studies, the Jewish people and the Amish people, really fascinating. So evangelicals in the States leave the church at a retention rate of 80%, meaning 80% of them, when they get to high college, say, whatever, I'm over it. Does anyone know the retention rate of Amish people, meaning what's the percentage of them that stay after they go into adulthood? Does anyone know? 95%. When evangelicals, about 20, maybe 30, maybe 40 at the highest best guesses. 95%. Now, a lot of people in the States say that the reason people leave the church is because it's condemning and it's conservative and it's really harsh. When what's more conservative than Amish people? Like, let's just be honest, right? So that can't be the answer. That can't be the answer. And he talks about, again, not only how the fact that they center their identity around a community, and he uses the table as an example there, meaning from the beginning, an Amish kid learns his identity at the table all three meals a day from the very beginning of their life. They have three books. They have the Bible. I think they have basically a song book, and then they have kind of their version of the Book of Martyrs, which is basically Amish people that have died as a martyr. And they basically, the patriarch, administer those and forms that identity from the very beginning at the table. And if you turn 18, can you imagine having 18 years of that? Like, you can't have another meal the same. Does that make sense? Meaning, like, that table represents something really, it represents your identity, because it's not you, it's not you alone. It's 10 other people, 5 other people. And it's really beautiful, too, that if someone does go prodigal in the Amish tradition, a lot of times they actually will keep that place setting empty in hopes as a sign that they're always invited back. That they're always, the seat is always open for them. And same with the Jewish people, right? Jewish people, have affected this world for the percentage of what they are in the world. You know, I think like, what, 7 to 8 million, and we have 7 billion people in the world. They have more Nobel Prizes than anyone else. They have all these accolades. They're, you know, the proportion of how they've affected the world is crazy. And he talks about, again, because they have an identity formed around a bigger story. And so I know it's a backdoor answer, but what I'm trying to say with that is we have to give kids a bigger story and not an individual one about just them and Jesus. It has to be like a real deep sense of community that we're calling them to be a family member. And again, I know that's not directly at the bullseye of what you asked, but I just have a huge heart for that, and I think we need to get back to that.
Thanks, Jeff. One more panelist answering here on this one, and then we'll have to wind it up.
Thought that came to my mind was just how do we communicate with students to students that the Christian hope is resurrection, it's not progress and success. And so the Christian hope is a discontinuity. The gospel is not sort of believe in Jesus and your life will go well and you won't have to suffer. And it's not that we can fix everything. And this relates back to an earlier question, I can't remember which one, about, you know, how do we manage to do Christian schooling and actually be honest with our students and say, you know, you can actually talk about failure and brokenness and ways in which the world's not perfect, ways in which Christian schooling's not perfect, ways in which we're not perfect, and be honest about the way things are and not gloss them over in the hope that if you give a more optimistic account, it'll sound more attractive. But to say, no, in the midst of all this, right, in the midst of our failure and finitude and imperfection and so on, God does resurrection and takes those things and gives them meaning. It's the hope is not that we'll somehow manage to get it all together and fix it all.
Mm, yeah. Thank you, David. I'm going to have to wind it up, Ken. I'm really sorry. The buses are going to leave. So thank you for coming. Come back tomorrow. Come back tomorrow, starting in at the same time, 8:45. Have a lovely dinner together with each other tonight. Can I have you thank the panelists, Ken, Jeff, Beth, and David? Thank you.
Welcome to an iTech 15 speaker presentation. This file has been brought to you by Christian Education National. Enjoy and connect to www.cen.edu.au for more information.